From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, the artist Gary Baseman, has been away for way too long. It's been almost 10 years since the feature film version of Teacher's Pet, but he's been very busy in the interim, including having a new show at the Skirball Cultural Center Museum. The show is called The Door is Always Open. Gary, first of all, it's always good to have you back.
Thank you, Elvis.
Because the show basically uses home as a setting, and in seeing all these rooms that are items from the house you grew up in, it made me realize how much of your stuff is connected to either embracing home or subverting home. I mean, that's kind of almost your complete axis as an artist, isn't it?
Well, I never really thought about it that way as an artist, because a lot of my home seems to be in this kind of mythical woods, or somewhere in my subconscious is where I seem to live. But when the Skirball invited me to have the exhibition, the home became the place where I guess I needed to present my work.
In these rooms in the exhibition, there are so many artifacts and pieces of furniture from the house you grew up in, but also so much of the work that you do sort of like examines what home means and uses home as a taking off point. And so many of the characters you've created sort of float around secrets and the idea that home can be a place where so many things that we acknowledge and come from the subconscious, I found to be a really exciting part of the way you work.
Well, I mean, within the last couple of years, I realized that with my family and the idea of home, that there were many secrets there. But growing up, I guess I remember talking to a writer who was telling me how, like, you spend half your life running away from home and then the other half coming back to home. For me, growing up, it was a place where my parents created an environment that was inviting for all their friends. And I remember that playing a big role, like in the living room, the dining room, the idea of celebrating, again, because my parents were both Holocaust survivors, and I was living in this world around Holocaust survivors. But then growing up and becoming a teen, and then in my 20s, and then wanting to prove myself as an artist, I really had to run away. It wasn't a place where I hung out. It wasn't where my friends would come and hang out with me. I'd always hang out at my friend's place. But for me now, it's, I guess, home is not a physical place. It's an emotional place. And when the Skirball invited me to have this exhibition, my goal was to create a place that was inviting to others. I didn't want people to feel that art was intimidating or something that they should not relate to, because I just know too many galleries in the fine art world that there's like a snobbery or almost like you're not good enough, you're not smart enough, you're not rich enough, you're not important enough, you're not cool enough, you're not hip enough, and it's like it's all bullshit. And the reality is art is about sharing ourselves, our visions, our stories, our life. And for me, I just happen to do it by drawing. Some people do it by singing. Some people do it by making films. Some people do it by just telling stories. Some people do it by hugging. So I wanted to create a place where people could come in, sit on my sofas, relax, and then engage.
Well, I always talk about making art more comfortable and more familiar, because LA galleries in the 80s were really incredibly sort of cold, snobbish places that judged you as you walked past. And a lot of the art that sort of came out of the 80s, that period, was art that was responding to that. And I almost wonder that was kind of the way you got your start too, and just sort of saying, I don't believe in that kind of boundary between artist and audience.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess it's not necessarily just being comforting, because I think art has to be challenging. And you have to take risks, and you have to try to get people to see things in new ways. And I try to put it all together in this exhibition, especially having it at the Skirball, which is a cultural center, and it's not a art museum. So they were also very particular on the work that was going to be exhibited.
It's funny because of the whole sort of familial thing to it, and a lot of the art that I've seen, you know, I'm a fan of, has a bit more of a sexual connotation, and none of that is there.
Yes, sir. And that was, that edict came down almost 8 months into the exhibition itself.
Really?
So it became another extra challenge, but it became a challenge to make sure that I produced strong narratives that went into this exhibition itself. So working with the curators, we created these video monitors in each room. So each room you got to hear me speak and actually go through my sketchbooks. So you could actually see the first drawing I did of like a cranium character and how that was developed. Or like with one of my art performances with Giggle and Pop, I could show you the original drawings I did and the ideas that came through my head, and then how I ended up working with Sarah Elgard as the dance choreographer and Karina Round with music to produce a performance piece that engaged the crowd to get them to sing and dance with us. So for me, I wanted people not to be afraid of the process and realize it all comes with an idea and that they can do that too. But I also wanted people to discover themselves. So I even went further into my heritage in understanding, which, again, I'm Jewish. I'm not religious.
And that kind of iconography is not part of your artwork at all.
It is now. It has been for the last 5 years.
It's kind of new to me, though, because there's a kind of a subtlety, because I always think a lot of your stuff, so that kind of Fleischer Brothers influence, mm-hmm. which has always seemed, in retrospect, kind of very sort of Jewish jazz age to me.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of the kind of the constantly bouncing joints and the round wide eyes and right. and that sort of like schism between being sexual and judging sexuality. I've often seen that in your work.
Right. No, that's true. In fact, when I was a little kid, I thought like the Fleischer cartoons and also old Warner Brothers cartoons were like perfection. So when I was like 10 years old, it's like, that is the perfect way to draw. And then I went into like Mad Magazine and Don Martin and things like that.
There's a great Don Martin sketch on one of the walls.
I know. That was for my first film. That was Super Pooper.
That's right, yes.
And that's what I did, a really poor animation. But I directed it, wrote it, and I edited it. You know, so that's where I was dealing with this, being a superhero that couldn't get his costume right. You know?
Yes, but that kind of bouncy movement, it's even in Super
right.
Pooper, that kind of like
oh, yeah.
the knees kind of going up and down all the time.
That film was basically like a Warner Brothers cartoon. If you look at the process, it's just like a gag after gag after gag trying to get this criminal.
But almost like kind of non sequitur gags, I mean, sort of commenting on that kind of stuff,
yeah.
but also embracing it, which is, again, what I think the whole exhibition does.
Well, I was brilliant at 14. So actually, if you looked at one of my pieces of art when I was 15 and a half, my mind was like out there, man. It was like psychedelic. It was in touch with everything and anything in that universe. And I didn't realize that 15 and a half was my high point.
My guest, who thinks he's been going backward ever since but hasn't, is Gary Baseman. His exhibition at the Skirball Center is The Door is Always Open. You're listening to The Treatment. But that thing you're talking about that you probably were first really conscious of when you were like 14, 15, sort of understanding that there's not that big a gap really between the conscious and the subconscious, is something that's always been in your work so far as I can tell.
Well, more so now. I mean, I got to a point where in life, because when I was younger, again, the way I describe it is I was like such a good kid. And I thought I was getting the frequent flyer miles of life by doing everything right, by like never ditching a day of school or never paying a dime of interest on a credit card and paying everything off and just being responsible for everyone and anything. You know, if I was going out with a girl and she was like a year younger, I thought, oh, maybe she's immature or whatever. I don't want to take advantage of her. You know, I was just so upfront. And the idea of truth, this idea of objective truth was so important to me. In fact, when I looked back at all my, because I had to look back at all my old sketchbooks and journals, that I realized when I was 20, I came up with this hand sign of truth. And I've been using this in my work lately, too. And so the idea of everyone having to live the same objective reality, and it got to the place that in my mid-20s, this acceptance of this subjective truth, that everyone can live their own personal truth. Also, you know, about 10 years ago is when I just wanted to live in my own surreal world. I gave up a lot of my commercial work, doing work for, you know, major magazines and newspapers and clients to just concentrate on my painting, but then on that world that I wanted to kind of create without the boundaries and the borders that were dictated to me by publications.
So funny you're talking about this, and I was thinking about it, especially in seeing it at the exhibition when I went, your first New Yorker cover, which is basically a bird in bed getting breakfast in bed served to by a kid, and the breakfast is eggs.
Right, it's his two little brothers.
Yes.
His twin little brothers.
Yes, exactly. it's just, as you were talking about all these worlds of yours and sort of the awareness is what you're really talking about, this kind of hyper awareness you had as a kid, a lot of it's in the illustration that you do. And I just, as you were talking about this, I flashed back to that New Yorker girl, which is what, from fall of 2002?
Yeah, I can't remember the year.
You've done a lot of illustrations
right.
since
no,
then,
I
obviously.
Did. That's the thing is, when I was an illustrator, I did 12 to 20 assignments every month for over a dozen years. I was like this machine, not a machine, because each piece I needed to think through and come up with a strong visual solution. But I handled a lot of work. I took everything on. I didn't travel. I didn't take vacations because I was so scared that Time Magazine would never call me again if they called me and if I wasn't available. So I just like took everything on, and I just wanted to do the best of everything that I was doing, but I'd also take risks. So I also worked with publications like Ray Gun, with David Carson, or Beach Culture, things that really gave me a lot of freedom to explore the visual end of it that actually ended up helping me become a painter.
All that, during that really sort of prolific period of yours, there seemed to be an excitement about the drawing. I mean, you almost had to do it like you couldn't contain yourself.
I still can't contain myself.
Yes, I'm looking at your sketchbooks right now, right here in front of me. That's
page after page,
page after page. But that's part of this continuing narrative you're talking about, too. I mean, one thing links to the next, doesn't it?
This was for music video I did for Mocha TV.
Oh, gosh.
Okay. It was the Buckingham Warrior. So Mocha TV allowed me to create this animated video. So it looks like a 1920s kind of Russian animation, but it's the tale of my father, which this character, the Buckingham Warrior, which I'm still owe you the figure. I didn't have time to get him out. He's the three-headed deer character.
Yes, absolutely.
So that was based on a story about my father, about his amazing will of survival in the woods of Poland, because he was a partisan, this freedom fighter. And that's also something that I've been obsessed with, that I've been working on. So one manifestation of it is this music video, and we used the music of De Antwoord, the South African white rap band, to tell like a Holocaust story.
How did you come upon doing that? Where'd that come from, the idea of bringing that music to?
My director, David Charles, who's actually a dear friend of mine, and he's also my writing partner. In fact, we just finished this beautifully tragic live-action film script. So I want to
move to live action now?
That's what you want to do next? Yeah, based on my characters, but it's completely live action. And it's a beautiful story, and we're starting to take meetings, and that's something that's really probably the dearest thing to my heart right now. So we worked on that for a year, and then he knew my travels to Eastern Europe, to the original hometowns of my parents, and so then we've been working together on the documentary of my travels to these towns that were completely mass murdered during the war. Even though I kind of knew these stories because my parents were Holocaust survivors, my parents really took the burden away from me so I could live the American dream. I was born on Sunset Boulevard, went to Fairfax High, you know, go to Disneyland, the Dodgers and everything. But when my parents got older, I needed to know their stories. And I created these characters, these magi spirits. They're like ghost-like characters. And for me, they're the keeper of your memories. And then when my father's health was failing and when he died, I realized, oh, my God, I'm his magi. I'm the keeper of his story. And if I don't tell his story, it'll be lost forever. And so I needed to understand that. And so that's why I needed to go back to his town, which he told me never to go to, that it was dead. You know, it's kind of like Superman having to go back to Krypton, even though his father said, you can't go back. There's nothing there. And then he actually does go back. And maybe it was destroyed and other civilizations are living there, but there are remnants. And maybe there's a few folks that actually lived there at the time of when his family lived there, and he could learn a little bit about it, even though everyone thought nothing else was there. That's actually a pretty interesting story, Superman story.
That's a great point of comparison.
Have they ever done anything like that? I have no idea.
We'll take a break. We'll come back and talk more about that. My guest, who thinks of himself as Kal-El, you know him as Gary Baseman. He's the artist whose new show, The Door Is Always Open, at the Skirball Center here in Los Angeles. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
I'm Jenny Radelet, producer of The Treatment. If you like this program, check out other podcasts from KCRW, including Bookworm, The Business, DNA, Unfictional, and Good Food. They're on iTunes or on KCRW's smartphone apps.
Welcome back to The Treatment. We were last on the planet Krypton with my guest, Gary Baseman, whose show The Door Is Always Open is at the Skirball Center through August 18th. As you were talking about that again, going back to your father's home and finding these remnants that were there to be unearthed, and this feeling of sort of ghosts of that previous world, your creations, your pieces, the magi you were talking about, are basically there to sort of help you embrace these ideas and to hold on to your histories and to hold on to your narratives, aren't they?
Yeah, very much so. So these are towns. My mom and dad's towns were like around for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of Jews. And my family's probably lived there for hundreds of years. My mom's town is Kostopol. My dad's town is Brezna. It's kind of like Burbank and Glendale. They're like right next to each other.
How far from Warsaw?
It's in now in Ukraine. It used to be Poland. It used to be Eastern Poland.
Poland, right.
And now it's Ukraine. Unfortunately, in the beginning of the war, the Germans decided to go straight there to that area and mass murder everybody. So my dad's town had 3,000 people. My mom's town had about 3,000 people. And everyone was mass murdered, except for maybe like 100. And my mom was fortunate that her parents put her on a train with her sister and her little brother and sent them off towards Russia. My dad, his luck wasn't as the same, but before he was taken to the pit to be shot, he was able to escape into the woods and ran into Russian paratroopers and spent 3.5 years as a partisan fighting in the woods of Poland. Both my mother and my father's parents were mass murdered in the pit. And so these towns are now these, I kind of describe them almost like Ukrainian New Jersey suburbs. And there's no remnant of Jews ever living there, even though back then it was like 80% Jewish. These thriving industrial towns. And now there's like, it's not much is going on there. And so even a lot of the buildings aren't there. And so—
What was it like to be back there and see that for you?
It was intense. It was so intense. But I needed to. I needed to walk the streets of where my father and my mother's house used to be. And then I needed to go visit the memorials where my grandparents were shot. I was the first one in 66 years to go back to these.
The first member of your family to go back.
To go back and at least pay respects to my grandparents and let them know that their blood is still flowing. But then when I was traveling there, a distant cousin of mine in Israel told me that there was a book about my father's town. And this is when things got really intense. So this is where I'm like as a little kid growing up thinking, I should be a famous artist. I'll be the famous artist. Now, when I hear this story, it's like, my dad should be famous. My dad's amazing. I mean, he had a heart of gold. He was, you know, he was an electrician. He was like a handyman in the neighborhood in the Fairfax district. But then the one story that he failed to tell me or any of my brothers or my sister, and it's in this book. So my cousin tells me that this book exists. She first sent me like a JPEG of it. And I'm like, I'm thinking, where in the hell is this? And, you know, because I'm going to Eastern Europe. And she's like, no, it's at the New York Public Library online. But it's in Yiddish and it's in Hebrew. But I don't read Yiddish or Hebrew. Then I go through Eastern Europe and I know what the story says. So in the book, it talks about how my father, as a partisan, comes back to his town in 1944. And he discovers three men who are responsible for the death of his parents and the other brethren. And he takes him to the outskirts of town and kills him. And he never told me this story. And it talks about how the other townspeople, the other Jews survivors started talking about it. And then the authorities found out, put my father and this other partisan in prison and sentenced them to death. And then somehow he got out. And he never told me this story. And this thing, my heart just like fell. I mean, I always loved my father. It just like turned how I saw him in almost a different way. I knew what Horry had to go through, but even more of what he had to do. That just built inside me, and I'm like, this is the story I need to tell.
It's the treatment. We're talking about family legacy, history, and continuing a narrative with my guest, the artist Gary Baseman, whose show, The Door is Always Open, is at the Skirball through August 18th. I certainly see where this idea of sort of secrets keep us alive plays a part in the shows, and there are these spaces that are kind of hidden. There's like almost a closet in every room in some way.
Yeah.
Was that always part of the conception of it?
Well, for me, the idea of like, even when I created Toby.
Right.
Toby was created to be the keeper of your secrets. But that was at a time when I was living my life and I was married and I was very unhappy. And I couldn't share my feelings with anybody. Again, my parents were married for 63 years. No one in my family's ever been divorced. And I didn't know.
And that was your secret shame, that you weren't happy in your marriage.
Right, exactly. And more so. And real other things that I've done that I didn't think I could share with anyone. You know, I tried to be a very honest person about everything and anything. So I created Toby not only to be my best friend, but to be the keeper of my secrets and to love me unconditionally. And so that became that kind of role or game, or what did that really represent? And just like with most of my art, It's not like I think it through and then I create it. I let my subconscious play a role in every page in my sketchbook and understanding, what the hell is this? Why is this little naked girl in bondage with tefillin with a Hasidic headdress? I have no idea. And a lion. I will understand this in a few months. But right now, I need it to pour it out from my soul onto the page.
Even Teacher's Pet is basically a story of a couple of secrets, and these two guys who, a kid and a dog,
right,
who keep secrets for each other.
Exactly.
So even that piece of mainstream entertainment is as much about your sort of like balancing all these things as anything else you've done that's just as personal.
Which I guess the narratives in life make it more interesting because of all the things that happen to us that make us want to have these secrets. I had this dance art performance.
Yeah, exactly.
Secrets and Truth. And that was the title of it. And the goal was we had to sacrifice the goddess of dreams. And so I worked with Sarah Elgard again, who I worked in the past. And we had 6 dancers and then 15 wild girls. And we created this experience and this narrative where I created the goddess of dreams and the princess of secrets. And again, the performance wasn't something for, I wanted people to just to sit and watch. I wanted them to be engaged, involved in it, and felt like they were part of the performance. But I ended up turning this story into the goddess of dreams needed to be sacrificed. And the goddess of dreams, to me, represented the dreams that we were told we needed to believe in as children. These unrealistic dreams of the white picket fence, riding off to the sunset, having to marry this particular girl or guy or this person or have this kind of job or have these goals, that when you become an adult, you're living with all these secrets and guilt because you're not fulfilling those goals because that's not who you were. That's not who you are. And so the idea of trying to accept who you are, if you want other people to respect you, you have to respect yourself. You know, like if you happen to be gay or if you like somebody from a different culture or a different ethnicity, or, you know, you have a different idea of what your career is or what kind of life you want to live, and it doesn't fit within the normal realm of what society deems as appropriate. So she needed to be sacrificed. And so I start off with the performance of the Princess of Secrets, who's holding all our world secrets, everyone's personal secrets, and she basically has a nervous breakdown. So she tosses the secrets in the air, she faints, she gets carried off, and the goddess of dreams unravels, and then eventually she gets sacrificed to fulfill our own personal dreams, the acceptance of our own dreams of how we want to live our life. Also, I had the wild girls go into the audience. They came up to individuals at the performance, and they told people to close your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Close your eyes.
Okay.
Okay, give me your hand.
Okay.
And then they said, imagine your dreams.
Okay.
The truth shall set you free.
Okay.
And then they gave them this medal. And this is a medal of truth.
Oh,
of
my
Veritas.
God. I have to tell you, the first time I've ever been terrified in history doing this show is when you told me to close my eyes.
But when I do these performances, I like having these memory pieces. No, this is for you.
Oh, okay. But that idea.
I'm not an Indian giver. But that's a horrible word, too.
Hey, this is public radio. You don't need to talk like that.
See, I know. I should. I mean, I feel bad now even saying that. What a horrible question.
That's okay.
I grew up in a wrong generation, so even that I said it.
No.
But they're also, this is actually adds into another element.
What?
Like when I was traveling through Eastern Europe to Poland, and I have a friend who has a company, Johnson Motors, and I wear a lot of their T-shirts. And again, he had like this Indian chief. This is like another element that just builds upon me. So I had this Indian chief on my chest, right?
Right.
And I wore it without even thinking about it. I'm at a restaurant in Łódź, in Poland, and they're taking me to a Jewish restaurant, they say. I'm like, oh, I'll love to compare the food to my parents' food. Because that's what I was doing through Poland. I was eating potato latkes and borscht and everything that my mom would make, but I was trying to see the similarity in that world. So it was like not just walking the streets, but I needed to taste the food and everything. So we go to this restaurant, and it's really odd. It's overly Jewish in a way. You know, the portraits on the wall, everything's like, and I look at the waitress and I go, she doesn't even look Jewish or anything like that. I'm thinking, there's not even Jews here. This is Łódź, where 250,000 Jews were mass murdered. And so at the end of the meal, they give us like a little Ronald McDonald toy or something like that. But it wasn't Ronald McDonald. It's a little Jew holding a coin. And it's like, this is because for good luck, because Jews are good at making money. And I'm like, holy shit. They see Jews the way the Irish see leprechauns, And then I'm like thinking about my shirt and the way they see Indians. And so for me, it's like this cliche, and it was like, it blew me away. Again, I grew up in a generation where everything was so multicultural, but then you could see these crazy things kind of come out, and that they even saw Jews as this, because again, even in Eastern Europe, I would hear so many stories of people talking about how, I think my grandfather was Jewish, you know, like all these people that did stay had to change their religion or hide who they were.
Right.
So again, the idea of these secrets.
That's just it. I mean, so many of these characters that you create like this are hugging is part of what they are, or embracing to help people sort of hold on to these essential parts of themselves.
Right.
Even to these characters, I mean, there's a very sort of tactile sense of touching and embracing and holding on to what makes you you in your work.
I think so. But I guess I'm getting to the point where I'm trying to just even accept myself. You know? Everything I do is pretty much in that same realm, is the idea of the acceptance.
Well, it gets back to the way we started the conversation, is home being a place that you embrace and then you leave and then you end up coming back to it.
Right.
This is what's happening to you now in your life, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess so. Like, the irony is the exhibition's title is "The Door is Always Open," which was a phrase my father would tell me, that no matter where I was in my life, that his home was my home. And that stayed with me. And then when my father passed, I was in charge of his eulogy and his headstone, even though I'm the baby of the family.
When did you lose your dad?
Like 3 years ago.
Okay.
Or a little more than that. And so on his headstone, I put that phrase, "The door is always open." So when I had this exhibition and I was creating this home, then I decided, well, first I was going to put my aunt's and uncle's furniture in the exhibition. But then when my mother passed away in October, then I made that decision. I'm putting my parents' real furniture in the exhibition. So you go to the dining room. That dining room set's my parents' dining room set. The bedroom set's my parents' bedroom set. It was taken out the first time in 48 years that it's ever been removed. And so it was such an emotional, personal event to do so. But I wanted people to be able to sit in these chairs and relax. You can go and watch episodes of Teacher's Pet on my parents' old TV set. I want people to feel comfortable. And then I worked with this company, Aztec, who did all the wallpaper. So they were so...
And the wallpaper is your work.
Exactly.
So very subtly sort of blended in to conventional wallpaper design.
Sometimes not so subtly. There are one of the wallpapers actually based on my parents' real hallway wallpaper that I had to walk up and down over and over again through my lifetime. So for me, it's like dealing with the sense of what a real home is. And the irony was that when I had this exhibition and I titled it "The Door Was Always Open," with losing my mom, that door would not be, at least the physical door is not going to always be open. I'm losing that home that I can't visit my mom or my dad, you know, in their home anymore. So it's kind of like this irony that it's now just an emotional home, which maybe it was always anyways.
Which means it always will always exist for you.
Yeah.
As an emotional home. We're out of time. Gary, it's always so good to have you here. Thanks so much for doing this.
Hey, thank you.
My guest is artist Gary Baseman, whose show, "The Door's Always Open," is at the Skirball Center through August 18th. A recording engineer who also mixes the show is Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radlett. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I want to be your boy. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.